Hello?
Hey, Rich, it's Larson. You got a minute?
Sure, Larson. What's up?
Well, hello and welcome to the Got a Minute podcast. I'm Larson Hicks, and I've got my co-host, Pastor Rich Lusk, here with me. How you doing, sir?
Great to be with you.
Awesome. Well, we're excited about this episode today. We've got David Bahnsen, author of Full Time, a book that has just very recently come out. This is his second time on the show, so it's great to have you back, Mr. Bahnsen.
Well, thanks for having me again. Good to be with you guys.
Yeah. Well, okay, so this book, I've been looking forward to this book for a long time. So you've teased it for quite a while. So you definitely built some hype, at least for a couple of us nerds out there who were really looking forward to this. I feel like this is a conversation I'm having constantly. I think it's a very timely topic. I recorded a podcast, a year and a half ago, titled Bored at Work. And it was kind of this, I was trying to capture some of these ideas that I think you did such a great job of covering in the book, is just this idea of men today, primarily that I see, are just not really all that engaged in their work. It's kind of perfunctory. It's kind of a means to an end, but it's not really something that they're passionate about or feel called to or really throwing themselves into. So I don't want to get out ahead of myself too far here on the book, but maybe you could just tee up for us, you know, why did you write this book? Like what's the problem that you're worried
about?
Well,
let me ask you, when you say that you've seen men that view their work kind of perfunctory and there's not a lot of inspiration or animation about the way they view work, are you referring to Christian guys or are you referring to just general observation in the culture?
Honestly, I think it's both. I guess it's a general observation of the culture, but I don't see a whole lot of differentiation, unfortunately, between Christians and non-Christians on this topic. I think everybody seems to view what you do outside of work as the real meaningful stuff of life, and work is not really. I think Christians have their own Christian version of that. But it's more or less the same attitude.
So what I would say as to why I wrote the book is because I actually view it the same way, that I do not see a distinction between the way people in the church and people outside of the church these days are speaking about work or feeling about work. And if I saw a distinction, the church would be in the losing hand. In other words, those rare moments in which I see people that are inspired by their work, ambitious, career-driven, visionary, they're almost always unbelievers.
Unbelievers. They're not Christian. Yeah.
So, absolutely. So if we had a situation where the church is doing this right, and by the way, like I would argue that the church does family right. But see, people will point out, well, what do you mean? Divorce is high in the church too, and a lot of people in the church are not preaching the right things about family. And I get all that. I'm not saying that we practice what we preach, but I don't think that there is a systemic problem of the Orthodox Church, meaning small o, churches that are still engaged in orthodoxy, that have systemically wrong views about family. There's always hypocrisy. There's always sin. But like, I don't think we struggle intellectually, theologically, systemically with what we feel about family. So if I think the world is losing a vision of family, the institution of family is becoming denigrated, but the church is holding the line, there's all kinds of people out there that could address it, write about it, and have, and it's less in my wheelhouse and area of concern. The reason work is an area that drove me here is I see the culture losing its uniquely American ethos about work, and I see the church accelerating the trend down, not helping, not serving as a line of defense. That's really the nexus of where the worlds in which I live are both failing in this regard. That's what motivated me to write this book.
Yeah. I think about the our heritage, you know, kind of the Protestant work ethic and sort of the view. I think I read this in De Tocqueville that the rest of the world referred to America as the land of the aughts. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that? The land of the aughts, the land of the zeros, where it's just like all the numbers coming out of America in the first century or so of America was all huge numbers. It was like these people are just so productive. They're having lots of babies. They're building and growing these farms and businesses. And that seems like, that was a distinctly Protestant. It was that was the phrase, you know, the term was the Protestant work ethic. And it seems like that's no longer something that people, when you'd say, you know, what's a distinctive characteristic of Protestants? I don't think that would be one of the first things that people would reach for is their work ethic.
It is a sad departure from our legacy, because you think about things like that. I mean, we talk about the Protestant work ethic or the Puritan work ethic. And that is very much what built our nation. David, you make the claim in the book that work is the meaning of life. And that's obviously a huge claim. Unpack that for us a little bit. What does it mean to say that work is the meaning of life?
Yeah, one of the things I've been trying to clarify for people that I think is perhaps a bit more arrogant of an assertion than they think I'm even making is not merely that I'm saying work is the meaning of life, but I'm saying that God said it was.
Right.
I would feel unqualified to say what the meaning of life was were it not for the way it is spelled out for me in Genesis chapter 1. And so the claim of the book is not so much David saying work is the meaning of life. Everybody already knows David is a workaholic, and David has this obsession with work, and David wants Christians to be more influential and productive in whatever their chosen vocation is. So I have my own agenda. That's good. But see, I got the agenda directly from the first pages of Scripture. And that's what the claim of the book is that work is the meaning of life. And I use the creational account to make that argument. To unpack it just briefly for those listening that haven't read the book, I think that you are forced into some real interesting hermeneutics when you go through the first chapter of Genesis, that the 25 verses that predate the creation of man allude to God taking a lot of satisfaction in a very beautiful creation. Some of the things he created would strike a lot of us as pretty overwhelming, you know, like water, planets, the solar system, the oceans, the animal kingdom, vegetation, and each one of them being described as good. And I think that when in verse 31, he goes on to say that he made mankind very good, that he provided verses in between verse 25 and then the conclusion in verse 31 that are the context of mankind receiving its extra modifying adverb. That verse, those verses I refer to are often called the cultural mandate, the dominion mandate, but most accurately, in my opinion, and also probably least agendized theologically. I don't have a problem with the agenda of the dominion mandate. I don't have a problem with the agenda of the cultural mandate. But I do think we use those words because we have an agenda. I just think it's an appropriate biblical agenda. But the creation mandate is pretty non-agendized, and it's pretty objectively true that God himself said, "Let us make man in our own image," and says four times in two verses that he made mankind to be image bearers of him. That there was an elevated dignity ascribed to what? To mankind as bearing the image of God. That God made us to be in a special communion with him with a special task. And that task is described in verses 26 through 28. To rule over the world, to be fruitful, to multiply, to fill the earth, to subdue the earth, to have dominion over everything on the earth. So I'm pretty fond of John Frame's really simple summary about creation being what God did and culture being what we do, that we deliver back to God out of his creation, something that we would call culture, what we do with it. But everything I just said, everything I'm describing, including procreation and what follows, the multiply, fill the earth thing, it bothers me when I see people in the church say, see, this is a verse telling you to have a lot of kids. Well, I kind of think it is, but what do they think you're supposed to do having a lot of kids without working to have a plumbing system and cities and infrastructure and streets and playgrounds and in other words, culture to build a civilization? How do you fill the earth just simply by procreating without economic activity? It's a totally absurd interpretation. And what we're talking about is work. Every single one of these verbs described, all pre-sin, as you know, all of this is before the fall. All of these things are describing God creating us with a burden, mandate, desire, blessing, objective to work.
Yeah, that's really good. And you know, if you start reading in Genesis 1:1 and you see God working to create, and then you come to man being made in the image of God, well, what's the first thing you're going to think of when you think that man is made to image God? God's been working these 6 days. If man is made in his image, man is going to be a worker too. And I think this theme actually carries over into Genesis chapter 2, where you get a more detailed account of the creation of the man and then the woman. And I think this is breaking down what happened on day 6 of the creation. And one thing that I find very interesting, and I point this out all the time, is that God created the man first. He created the woman later on that day. But when God created the man, he gave him a job to do before he gave him a wife. He had work before he had a wife. He had a mission, you could say a vocation. He had a mission before he was married. So there's something obviously incredibly foundational to work in human life, and we can say in particular in a man's life, the man was made to be a worker, to work and guard the garden. That's the specific. If have dominion and rule over the earth is the broad command for Adam, the specific form of that is to work and guard the garden in the very beginning. So I think you're exactly right to trace it that way. And that brings me to something else that I thought was really interesting in your book. You identify a lot of problems that I think have cropped up in our culture, including in the church, because of the way we have marginalized work. One is just general unhappiness. People lack purpose. They lack direction. They lack meaning in their lives. If work is the meaning of life and people are marginalizing work, obviously their lives are going to feel meaningless. The meaning or purpose of life is going to be diminished for them. So you've got all of the, what you might call the mental health crisis, the general unhappiness, the malaise that seems to have set over our culture. You also talk about declining labor participation rates, particularly on the part of men. Another thing we see in our culture is either people delaying marriage or simply not getting married at all. So you've got a number of different problems here. You've got people who are not being productive. You've got people who are unhappy. You've got people who aren't forming families. But it seems to me that all of these different problems that we can identify, that the sociologists have identified for us, and I can put numbers with it and all of that, it seems in a lot of ways all of these problems are threaded together. They're all linked together as really part of the same fundamental issue.
Well, they most certainly are, Rich, but I would argue not only are they threaded together, that they feed on each other, that they form either negative feedback loops or positive feedback loops. And so I become very fond. My friend Anthony Bradley talks about people who are employable being marryable, people who are marryable, people who are marryable being employable.
This is
a huge issue for men that I know we could. I mean, if people want to just sit around and play dumb or deny it, that's fine. I think all that stuff can be adorable. But a woman doesn't want to marry a man who can't hold a job. I mean, is this like news to people? A man has the confidence, a man has the self-worth, a man has the dignity to be out looking for a life partner, a commitment, a relationship, when they feel better about themselves, about their work, about their sacrifice, about their abilities, their talents, their achievements, those things in a career context feed their drive to pursue marriage, but they also feed the attraction because of human nature. Totally.
Well, and I think you know, you didn't spend much time, I don't think, in your book on gender, and I understand probably why you didn't, but in my mind,
because gender is just a construct, so I didn't want to.
That's right.
Yes. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, just to go back to Genesis and the creation mandate or the dominion mandate, you know, the. You go to chapter 3, and I think the roles of husband and wife are reinforced in the curses, where the mandate is gendered. You know, there's the fruitful multiply thing that seems to be directed more at the wife, at Eve, and the dominion subdue thing, which seems to be pointed more towards Adam. Both are needed for both tasks, obviously, but there's an emphasis, and I think we see that emphasis in the curse. You know, the woman is cursed in childbearing, and the man is cursed in his work. And so I think that orientation. I think sometimes people have a hard time, you know, holding multiple ideas in their head at the same time. You know, and it's like the idea that when we die and we look back on our lives, that we can say one of the most important things, if not the most important thing that we will have done with our lives, is raised godly children. That can be simultaneously true and also be able to say, but that's not the main task that God's put me, like that I'm supposed to spend 8 hours a day focused on, you know, that he gave me a helpmeet. And I'll just add the other thing that I've brought up a number of times here on this podcast is this idea that the word submission, you know, it literally means to come under the mission. And so a woman submitting to her husband, I believe, it looks like her first seeing a man who is on mission, who is doing something, who has a purpose, has a direction, has a task. And she is going, I'm signing up to be a part of that. That's something I want to sign up to be a part of that and help that man accomplish the mission that he is on.
Yeah. I agree with you. I would add, it may not mean, and I know you don't mean this, that she sees a man who's already in the corner office. It may mean that she sees a man who has a vision for where he wants to go in his career. I become a bigger and bigger fan of younger marriages in the sense that the biggest argument, first of all, a lot of it is I just don't think the other plan has worked very well. I live in New York City. I see a lot of single women in their mid to late 30s, and they just don't strike me all the time as being a lot happier than women are getting married younger. And just even apart from a micro assessment, a macro assessment, you know, if I start seeing society-wide prescriptions for Xanax and Prozac dropping a lot, I might change my mind, but it doesn't look like it's working well. But here's the thing. Yeah. I don't believe that the man at age 20 is supposed to have achieved his career goals or even know exactly everything he's going to do. I think that what a woman might see in a man at a young age is a man who's contemplative about these things, who is considering their future, their mission, their vision. I also would add, too, with total agreement with you about the emphasis of the curses in Genesis 3, which I distinguish from a normative, that the Proverbs 31 woman is simply not a woman who's removed from the workforce. It just isn't. So I have a lot of regard for us packing in these theological concepts and foundations with appropriate nuance and complexity and everything. And I think it's a really exciting process to do that. But the sequence that you describe in Genesis is very important, and you're exactly right. Back to the image-bearing component, not only, Rich, do I agree with what you said, that the entire context when we get to the verse where he says, I'm going to make you my image, is God has been sitting here working and creating and producing. And then he goes on to ask us to go extract this value from creation, to co-create with him. But I try to make the point in the book theologically that we can somewhat answer what it means to be an image bearer of God by starting with what it doesn't mean. See, if someone just said, well, God made us to be like him, and yet we immediately eliminate the areas in which we cannot be like him. The original sin is man trying to be like God. What does this mean? To know all things, to control all things, to do all things. The omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience of God are not characteristics that we can share with him. But then yet we know we're made in his image. What that can only refer to is the creative and productive capacity of God. And yet, even then, it is limited by God being God and man being not God. That God can create out of nothing, and we can only create out of the nature God has given us, out of the natural world. That distinction is the essence of the creator-creature distinction. Yet it is not merely a statement on the limit of mankind. It is a statement on the capacity of mankind. It has a negative and a positive. The positive is that mankind can go invent an iPhone. First, can invent a wheel and learn how to start a fire and build a city and build civilization. And as we know in the ancient world, you know, we talk sometimes as we're all born in this modern era, that, you know, the building of the Brooklyn Bridge on into the digital revolution, we've done some pretty unbelievable things in the last 100 to 150 years, post-industrial revolution and modern life. But, you know, the Egyptians built some pretty amazing pyramids. I mean, this is mankind's creative capacity that goes back to the garden, and it is a direct elaboration of mankind as an image bearer of God.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good. And going back to what you said, I really do like that that frame line that you cited, the line from John Frame, that, you know, God has given us creation and then culture is what we do with it. There's an interesting verse in Genesis 2. So this is after God has completed his work of creation. And then it says, there was no bush of the field, when no bush of the field was yet in the land, and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up. For the Lord God had not caused it to rain on the land, and there was no man to work the ground. Yeah. So what's going to make creation fruitful is human labor. Rain plus human labor equals fruitfulness. And I would actually even put it this way. The raw materials that God has created plus human labor plus human knowledge equals civilization. So think about things like this. Oil is in the ground. That oil is of no value until man figures out some use for it. I mean, the idea that, say, Westerners went into the Middle East and stole these resources away is really kind of nonsense, because oil was just something that got in the way when you were trying to dig a well until man invented uses for it. And then all of a sudden it became valuable. But prior to that, it was not valuable at all. Or to think that we can take sand and melt it down and turn it into a computer chip and then run electricity through it and have it solve all kinds of problems for us. There's all kinds of things like that. God has built incredible resources into the creation, and man's task, you could say in a way, the purpose of man's existence is to figure out how to put those created resources to use for the sake of human flourishing.
Right.
Well, that's exactly right. And see, that's where the subject of this book and that understanding of economics, and one of my favorite phrases I use with students is work being the verb of economics, is that I'm not a theologian, and I didn't pretend to be one in the book. I probably got a little more theological and exegetical than I often do. But I do economics for a living, and I don't believe any of this stuff can be separated from the field of economics. Nor do I believe the field of economics can be separated from this stuff. At the end of the day, this is what we're talking about. When we talk about the allocation of scarcity and decision-making that takes place in the context of risk, in the context of productive human activity. This is what economics is. And it is a byproduct of mankind utilizing the natural resources of the physical world. But mankind is not only able to take two physical things and mold them together in a way, to take wood and then shape it in a way that creates a wheel, and all of a sudden we can start getting some utility from a wheel. Mankind does that, but there's the ideas that are imputed. It was the idea, which is what you're getting at, the ingenuity that goes into what will be done with a wheelbarrow, what will be done with a silicon technology, what will be done with fossil fuels as a source of energy. This is intellectual, but it defies the animal kingdom that is limited to almost survival instincts. Our ability to be contemplative. By the way, there's a lot of beautiful stuff about this in Catholic social thought. I've really learned a lot of anthropology. I don't think it's unique from Protestantism, but we share this in both Catholic and Protestant traditions. This understanding of the human person. This is a theological idea that is itself the beginning of economic understanding. And our inability as Christians to formulate an economic worldview that starts with this human anthropology is the reason today people are becoming more distrusting of what they errantly call capitalism.
Right.
Yeah, that's really good. So, David, the claim that I say that you make, but obviously that you believe Scripture is making, and I would agree with that, this claim that work is the meaning of life. It seems to me that for work to function as the meaning of life, we have to set our work in the context, or realize that our work is set in the context of the creation mandate. I mean, that's what makes work the meaning of life, is you really have to have a theological understanding of work, and it's got to be set in the context of the creation mandate. So then it seems to me that if a culture or a civilization rejects God and rejects the authority of God's word, it's no longer going to understand the purpose of work, or it's no longer going to understand why work is the meaning of life. Obviously, people will still continue to work, but they won't be working perhaps in the same way. But it seems to me this is true for Christians too, that if Christians don't understand the creation mandate, they're really not going to understand the place of work in their lives.
No, that's right. But I think that there's an important theological point here. Do I believe that the folks at Apple that created the iPhone were living out the creation mandate without epistemological self-consciousness? I do. Do I believe a heart doctor that performs cardiological, you know, life-saving operations is performing activities out of what mankind was created to do? I do. And do I think that they understand all that? I don't. So right. I think the point you're making puts a heightened burden on Christians. If you're going to know what to do and why, all the more so should you be tying that to the beauty of this special revelation. And when we don't do that, I think it's a shame. So there is a sense, without getting into all the theological nuance, but just for simplicity's sake, that there's a common grace that I think is really evident out of the cultural mandate, that we have incredible capabilities from unsaved people to do work, to do productive activity, and that they only do that because God made them to do it. Their inability to know the source of it and the reasons for it is a shame, and it's one of the great calls to a saving faith in Jesus. But when Christians have that saving faith, and are not epistemologically self-aware, theologically cognizant of these creational truths, I think it's even more disappointing.
Yeah, right. That's really, really good. So David, when you hear people in the culture and politicians and whatnot talk about, say, the desire to have a 4-day work week, and that would make things so much better, or a 32-hour work week. I think that's what Bernie Sanders recently proposed. how do we push back against that?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people took it as a joke, and maybe I was being a little tongue-in-cheek, but the more I've thought about it, the more serious I am that one of the ways to push back pragmatically against Bernie Sanders' idea is to point out to about half of his people that this would mean that you'd have to work a lot more than they're currently working to get up to 4 days a week.
32 hours.
That might really upset some people, but the you can't push back on it any other way than theologically. That ultimately, the argument that we now can work less, therefore we should, is non-falsifiable. It is, of course, elitist to the core. It's a reference to a very limited number of occupations. It is untrue that we can work less and therefore should for the vast majority of occupations. But to the extent there's certain things with kind of a high-end computer programming or some forms of in the service economy, that may very well be true. But there's a lot of blue-collar people that would be shocked to know that they can work less. But regardless, the argument as to why they shouldn't is normative. 6 days shalt thou work. And that the telos embedded in work would suggest that we don't need to be sitting. What if we could, by Bernie's calculus, whatever it is he thinks needs to be done in the economy in a day? Marx thought that we would do what? Poetry in the morning and fish in the afternoon? Or was it the opposite? Mm-hmm. I can't remember.
Something like that.
I never paid attention to the fishing versus poetry thing because both sounded so boring to me that I was just really grateful that Marx's revolution never surfaced. But I think that Bernie's idea, taken to its extreme, would mean that if we could work one day a week, we should do that too. So there's a very this isn't a straw man. The argument is that we should work as little as possible because the purpose of life must be something that is not work. And in by this calculus, it's leisure and recreation. And my argument against that is that the Bible tells me differently, that I'm to rest one day a week and I'm to work 6 days a week. And in that work, there is going to be opportunity for fellowship, for achievement, for camaraderie, for overcoming challenges. There will be sweat of the brow. There will be stress, anxiety, but there also will be blessing in overcoming that. So Bernie's argument is not only preposterous for all the reasons people will and have jumped on it, the basic desire to have the state centrally plan more of economic affairs and move us into a more European-like, not only economy, but culture. That's the agenda for the far left. That's fine. But my antidote is not, no, we need more labor productivity or unit productivity. My argument is teleological, that mankind's purpose is to work. So why in the world would I want to do less of it?
Right. So even if robots took, say, were able to do a lot, which obviously they already do, but say that kind of trend continued, even if you had your economy was such, or your just personal wealth was such that you did not need to work, you would say it's still incumbent upon us to find productive labor to engage in because it is the meaning of life.
That is exactly right. But there's two different things you've said there. One is regarding someone with financial convenience and surplus, and one is efficiency. I am all for robots doing things I don't need to do. And my motive in having robots do things I don't need to do is so I can do more things.
Exactly.
And this started, out robots and AI and tech and all the stuff that people who've never read Ecclesiastes insist on saying are new. And just go back to the wheel. We invented the wheel to do things easier and simpler. I imagine from what I've seen of the Egyptians building the pyramids, the people were sick of carrying things a long way in their hands. So they wanted to put it in a wheelbarrow that they could wheel it up a hill. It's just a theory I've come up with here. Okay. So I have had two cups of coffee as we're sitting here this morning recording, and I didn't make either of them. And I didn't go extract from the ground the coffee beans. And I didn't even, like the old days, grind the coffee beans someone else did the hard work for and even put them into a filter and actually make it, which I did do for years until I had a Keurig. I don't really know how I get the coffee in my cup. It's not robots, but it's sort of like robots. The process got easier. And it got easier because of human ingenuity combined with technology. And this is sort of the process of industry playing itself out. So I'm glad my coffee was easier. You know what I did in the 4 minutes I saved versus the old way of making a coffee to the new way? I cleared out more emails and communicated more with clients and read up more on pre-market activity and so forth. It was efficiency. Yeah. So that's what I think we should embrace robots.
Right.
Yeah. So those labor saving devices are not about you avoiding labor, but you doing labor that's more efficient for you or more specifically tailored to who you are. I think that's a good way to think about it. So let me ask another question building on that. Obviously one thing that we have to do is teach our children a work ethic that feeds into this view that arises from and feeds into this view of life. Thoughts on that? Well, you know, it seems to me that the desire to escape work is tied with so many other things you see going on in our culture, the desire to escape responsibility, just a general softening of the culture where people don't want to do hard things. People want to avoid suffering at all cost. There was the book that came out a few years ago, The Coddling of the American Mind. Obviously, we do live in a culture that tends to really coddle people and insulate them from challenges and risks and anything that might be difficult or that would require sacrifice. So in a culture like the one we live in, it's obviously very countercultural to teach your children a work ethic. What are some ways that we can approach that?
Well, I have a feeling I generally kind of know the audience of this podcast a bit. And so I would say, let's hit where it hurts, okay? I think that every Christian listening is going to be very comfortable saying and hearing the right things, that we shouldn't coddle people. We should teach them a Christian view of work ethic. I think everyone's on board there. And in the world, there is increasingly a desire to coddle. There is increasingly a poor understanding of theology of work. But what I think is a common misnomer in the church that is not necessarily a common misnomer in the world is that the purpose of life is to raise godly kids. Well, see, I think that we need to raise godly kids. But I think Larson, you talked about this earlier. If we do say that, I wish people would understand that we're going to get less godly kids, and we're certainly going to get less godly view of work. Because it's only a matter of time till someone realizes that it's a theological Ponzi scheme. The purpose of life is to raise godly kids, not for them to grow up to be dominion workers, but then for them to raise godly kids, not for them to grow up to be dominion workers, but for them to raise godly kids, not for them. I can keep doing this, but you get the idea. Is this what we believe the point of raising godly kids is? Is for why do we want our kids to be godly? So that they will grow up and raise godly kids? So that they will do it? Or at some point, do we actually want to define what godly means? At some point, do we want to apply it into an actual creational understanding, into a real world activity? And I had a pastor once who I know meant well, but it bothered me. This is a young age. It was a little after my dad died, but I wasn't deep into my career yet, but I was working very hard. I was in my young 20s. And he said, you're right that the Bible is really clear about how important work is, but it's more clear about how important family is. And if you're ever in a position where you got to pick, you got to pick family. And that answer is not, no, you got to pick work. The answer is reject the absurd false dilemma.
Yeah.
It is totally untrue
That's right.
that a godly person has to pick between do I raise my family well or do I work hard? Both and always and forever or none of the above.
Yeah. No, that's a good word. It's a good word. And I think, I mean, that's exactly, you're hitting the nail on the head. I think this is the biggest, at least in our circles, the biggest pushback to your argument is going to be, no, the purpose of life is raising godly children. And I even had a conversation about this, and somebody wanted to argue that be fruitful and multiply came first and therefore is more important than subdue and take dominion, which I don't think there's a you know, to Rich's point, Adam was given a task before he was given a wife. So he was given work first. I think it's just absurd to pit the two against each other.
But does be fruitful, multiply did come sequentially first. So now the question is, what does it mean, be fruitful, multiply? If be fruitful and multiply does not inherently and immediately denote work, then what you mean is, I don't mean to be crass here, what you mean is procreate children so they can all die.
Right.
Because you will have no nourishment, you will have no food, you will have no water, you will have no means of supporting all this multiplicative activity you're doing. It was inherently embedded in the commandment of be fruitful, multiply, to work.
Well, and I don't think, and I also don't think the image of God is borne out on us by merely subsisting, right? I think that's the other false dichotomy here is I'm gonna go live on a farm by myself. We're gonna have a little subsistence hobby farm and live on our own, which first of all is kind of laughable today to try to LARP as a homesteader because you drive to Walmart four times a week probably. And so you're not really, the subsistence that our ancestors, the homesteading our ancestors had to do was a 24/7, task. It's not anymore. But that to me is this like selfish lifestyle choice, and I say that as somebody with a lot of dear friends who are pursuing that. View that as the calling, but to me there's a quote from your book where you're talking about purpose, and you said purpose reverses a life where things are done for us to a life where we do things for others. And I think that's the golden rule, that economic activity, engagement in the marketplace is service to others. It's finding problems out in the world around you and pouring yourself out for others in the pursuit of solving those problems for people. And if you do it in a way that is effective, people will give you money for it. And it continues.
Well, I agree entirely as the economy has grown, evolved, modernized, changed, we have even more opportunity to serve with productive activity. That there was a time in the course of human history in which, for our needs to be met, we were doing work that was directly meeting them, and we got to a point where we could have our needs met by meeting the needs of others. This is one of the beauties of what we'll errantly call capitalism. In a market economy, we created a division of labor. And now, to the extent someone has a matter of preference, a matter of nostalgia, sometimes I'm going to go out on a limb and say a matter of societal cowardice. Good motives or bad motives, I don't care. People that want to go be on their farm and not be engaged in commercial society and have the needs of their family met. Here's the thing. How many of those people have you ever met that are willing to limit it to their own personal choice without them deciding to cast aspersions on the rest of us who have felt the need to work in finance, technology, agriculture, manufacturing, education, and other forms of commercial society that impact others? It's never a personal decision. It is a personal decision that is now said it should be your personal decision too. And this was a big thing I talked about in the introduction of the book is, if all we're talking about is some people are type A and some people are a little more reserved, then it would be fine. But that isn't what we're talking about. The type A people do not sit around telling the reserved people to go work late. The reserved people tell the type A people to quit working late. That's what we're talking about. Yeah. It's a purely one-sided thing here. And I agree with you, by the way, that there is a selfishness embedded in it. But at the end of the day, my point is you cannot live out the cultural mandate by deciding that you will only work in a way that doesn't meet the needs of others. that as long as I can hunt my own game and fish my own fish and somehow, you know, get our own water, that we are living up to it, that it is completely inadequate. And I would add that vision of child rearing that hopefully is properly centered around character traits and development of virtue and the right. sort of spiritual formation you want to see, but spiritual formation divorced from equipping them to live in the world, we can't be theologically satisfied with this.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's Rich really and good. I had a whole podcast about, you know, because we wanted to talk about this whole living in the city versus living in the country, sort of farm life versus city life. And we sort of talked about, you know, it seems like heaven is sort of a combination of a garden and a city. It's kind of, it's got elements of both. And
Revelation 21 and 22, the garden city. Yeah.
Right.
And now, so you don't take that to be a eschatological fulfillment of the garden, that the city is the old garden becomes the new city.
I think that's true. But I think what you see is within the city, there are all kinds of garden features. Yeah. So all kinds of features. So obviously Eden has transformed into the new right. Jerusalem, but it's brought with it all of these features. So now there's not just one tree of life. The river of life is lined with trees of life. So mm-hmm. There's been this, this glorification and maturation of the garden, but you have not lost the garden features. Yeah.
That's good.
Right. But we talked about one of the themes I think we pulled out of that conversation was this idea that, you know, sort of the farm and the country life is sort of this tutor. We tend to, I think a lot of people are drawn to that world because of the simplicity of, I'm going to work with my kids. I'm going to work with my hands. We're not going to be distracted by pornography and all of the news and all the stuff that just drags us down. We're just going to focus on
which is very true. There is no possible way for there to ever be any sexual sin at a farm.
right. Exactly. No, but exactly. Wherever you are there, you know, wherever you go, there you are. As my old pastor used to say. But the point that we were making was that, you know, is that the movement in scripture is towards the city and Proverbs is a king in a metropolitan context, speaking to a son who's inheriting a kingdom in a metropolitan context and who has been given much greater responsibility, but that also comes with much greater exposure to a lot more temptations, a lot more dangers. You know, you have a lot of wealth now and you have a lot of access to things that you didn't have when you were out on the farm necessarily. So there is this expectation, I think, in this movement in human history from immaturity and simplicity to maturity and complexity. And I don't think it's a good thing for us to just put our heads in the sand and wish that it would just all go back to the farm.
Well, I agree 100%. And that's a huge theme of things I talk about and am animated by is this maturation in our thinking and the progress, both in society, but also in the way that we think about these things. Look, at a very base level economically, I think it would be helpful for people to understand why cities were ever born to begin with. Why are there such things as cities? Why are there people who live close together? Because it made trade easier. That's it. What is trade? Where does wealth come from? The production of new goods and services and the ability to freely exchange those. And because of subjective value, the kid on the playground gets richer because he wants the baseball card more than he wants the candy bar. The other kid wants the candy bar more than the baseball card. Now, those are consumption items, and so there's other examples that can be used. But we create wealth through free exchange as we have different needs and wants. And the tighter proximity that a city affords obviously just facilitated a higher volume of transaction and an efficiency. Now, I agree, by the way, that there is a sense in which the more cosmopolitan and metropolitan context provides more opportunity for idolatry and other forms of sin. This debate is largely sociological. It's almost entirely preferential. It's one person likes chocolate, another person likes peanut butter, but they decided to hate each other over it. And this goes back to the founding of the country. Jefferson and Hamilton hated each other over cities versus farms. That's really what we're talking about. Right. So today when I hear my friends in New York refer to people in the South as hicks or lesser thans, or when I hear my friends in Montana, you know, talk about these evil big city people, I think both of them are absurd. Mm-hmm. There is a need and a benefit to both suburban, rural, urban, various different diversified contexts. But do I think that there is an advancement and progress that plays out and that vision of a city? I do. And I think that the heavenly language you refer to from Revelation is somewhat unavoidable. And I think Augustine's language, city of God, city of man. But I found a sermon that my late father had given where he's pointing out that the city of God was not born after the fall. Mm-hmm. The city of man was. Mm-hmm. The city of God was pre-fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so it's interesting to me when you read through the Torah, which is given to Israel, obviously, as they're going to go dwell in the land of promise. And obviously, it's a very agrarian economy at that point. You don't have a lot of teaching on work, like how important it is to work, because if you don't work, you just starve to death. You don't have a lot of warnings in the Torah about drunkenness, because who's got time for that? But as society gets more developed and becomes more prosperous, as you start to enjoy the fruit of your labors, then the temptation to laziness can set in. And you've got a lot about that in Proverbs. The temptation to go get drunk sets in, and you've got a lot about that in Proverbs. And these things come with, I don't think it's so much a function of, say, agrarian life versus city life as it is prosperity brings with it a new set of temptations, new opportunities to sin that perhaps weren't there before. So I think that's maybe one way to look at
it. And I think that I think with greater prosperity is a more temptation to rely on mankind's activity, divorced from gratitude in God. And that's the warning. Manna that is pretty prevalent throughout Scripture, but it is never connected to a warning against work.
Right, exactly. Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think there's also, in a prosperous society, the temptation to rely on the work of others, which is really, the declining work ethic that we see among Americans and the increasing interest in, say, socialism obviously go together. I would also say that the rise of socialism and the sexual revolution go hand in hand. Wanting to take what doesn't belong to you sexually is of a piece with wanting to take what doesn't belong to you economically.
You're right about that historically as well, not just ideologically, because the sexual revolution and the Great Society coincided.
Go hand in hand. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And they both destroy work ethic. They both destroy productivity, and they both destroy the family.
And they were never going to be possible apart from the material prosperity that we were living through post-war. So they like most spoiled children, are a byproduct of ingratitude.
Yeah, that's really good. Well, I know we're kind of getting short on time here, but I did want to ask you about one further thing, and maybe Larson's got another question for you as well. But obviously, a lot of your book is aimed at pastors, which I did appreciate. And I thought you had a lot of great counsel for pastors about how to preach on these topics and engage on these topics. And I think you're right about rejecting the false dilemma. And I think a lot of preaching and teaching on work has operated in terms of a false dichotomy and spoken of things like work-life balance when that's just a false construct. That's not a helpful way to set it up. And quite honestly, I have also seen a lot of lazy pastors and have thought to myself, well, one reason why you probably don't preach on work is because you really don't work that hard yourself. And one reason that you probably downplay things like a godly ambition, what it might be to have a godly drive, is because you don't really have much of that yourself. So I've certainly seen that. I'm wondering if you've got further, basically flowing out of what you say in the book, I certainly think there's a huge need for pastors to teach and preach on, as you say in the book, work as the meaning of life. I think that's incredibly important. How would you say if a pastor finds himself in a situation where he sees a lot of men in his, and I say men because I think that's particularly where the problem shows up, a lot of men who are not being as productive as they should, and who maybe even justify that on grounds that spending my time, say, with family or something like that is more is godlier and more fruitful for me. How would you tell pastors to how would you help pastors think through how to approach that with their congregation, how to cultivate within their congregation a godly ambition and a godly understanding for work as the meaning of life?
So I think you know that I'm a little stuck in two worlds when it comes to evaluating the church today and pastors, two contexts, because I come from a small Reformed church world, right? My dad was a pastor in a small Presbyterian denomination. The churches were reformational and small. And that's largely the theological world that I am surrounded by and choose to be surrounded by, is something that's more distinctive theologically and a little less broadly evangelical, non-denominational, and mainstream. Yet I am often in mainstream, larger evangelical circles. The church that we call home in New York City is a good-sized church, largely because the preaching is just so faithful that the remnant of Christians in New York want to hear it. And so the church itself is actually an encouragingly large, but very, very distinctive in its, you know, quite Kuyperian preaching. But the reason I set it up this way is I see two different things that I'm dealing with. And a pastor, a Reformed church with 200 people, I think might be facing a different problem than this kind of larger evangelical context. But I consider all of it in the Catholicity of my faith important. And I consider all of it facing the burden I talk about in chapter 9 of the book. But see, in that larger evangelical setting, the critique I have a lot of pastors is that they're not shepherds. That they would say we're working hard because they're organizing board meetings and doing real estate prospecting and trying to set up the new vision casting team and hire the new round of consultants and other things that make me pretty much want to throw up. While in the smaller Reformed church, I don't think they're doing all these consultants and vision casting and board meetings and running their church like a Fortune 500 corporation. But then I also don't really count all the time they spend blogging as shepherding either. Mm-hmm. And so there's different manifestations of where I'm concerned about the work ethic of the pastorate. I'm also quite confident already with less than 2 months of the book release that this hasn't landed the way I wanted it to, because all I'm doing on a daily basis is getting notes from pastors telling me how much they agree. And they can't all think, yeah, I can't be right if they all think I'm right. There must be someone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all
the nasty stuff will be coming soon. I'm sure there's
all in due time. Yes. The answer to your question is, Rich, pastors have to know their congregation and preach to what the error in the congregation is. And if the error in the congregation is that all of the men are working until midnight every night and they're never seeing their families, then great, preach on it. But let me know where that church is. Yeah. I'd like to go hire some of those people. But it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist, and they all know it. And so where the problem is, and now I think about some of the large evangelical churches in Orange County, California, where I've spent a lot more of my adult life, and they're preaching the sermon about men not working too hard when they are just filled with 30-year-old men still living at home. Okay? Yeah. Preach to where the prophet needs to be. That's what I would say.
Yeah,
that's good. Yeah.
I'll close us out here if that's okay with kind of a final question, and maybe I'll answer the question and let you respond to my answer. So I think just to bring it full circle, I want to I want to define what work is. And I'd love to hear your definition of work, because it's obviously been the centerpiece of our conversation. My own view is that work is, it's not dependent on, you know, it's not what you do for a living necessarily. It's how you're transforming the world around you and making it a better place, and applying the gifts that God's given you, the talents that God's given you, the resources God's given you, to making your community, making your church, whatever it is, the world around you better. And I'll read the quote from your book that you put in there from your favorite 16th century workaholic, John Calvin, because I thought it was fantastic. And I think calling is ultimately, this is another one of my favorite topics, is for men, career men, to start to, you know, take risks. We talked about marrying early and not starting in the corner office. You know, it's really a journey. But it's a journey of trial and error to discern sort of what it is God has put you on this planet to do, what it is that you, that you know, what he has given, what good works has he prepared for you to do, right? So here's the quote. The Lord bids each of us in all of life's actions to look to his calling. Each individual has his own kind of living assigned to him by the Lord as a sort of sentry post, so that he may not heedlessly wander throughout life. The Lord's calling is the beginning and foundation of well-doing. No task will be so sordid and base, provided you obey your calling in it, that will not shine and be reckoned very precious in God's sight.
Well, it's hard to improve upon the great Genevan scholar. When you ask me what I believe work is, I think your definition and your elaboration is very helpful, very good. I wouldn't push back on any of it. At a basic economic definition, I define work as the production of goods and services that meet the needs and wants of humanity. Because I think that we're largely going to have a more reformed listening base here, I love the opportunity to upset everybody by quoting a great Roman Catholic. I think John Paul II's construct of work as a transitive activity whereby a subject extends an activity towards an object is a very helpful metaphysical definition. Work is the worker doing something for the purpose of serving an object, which is the people that benefit from the goods and services being produced. So you are right. That definition, whether I use a little more Catholic social thought, theological one, or a just basic economic one that I have really worked on over the years and found that definition to be unimprovable. In either case, it does not require a paycheck. The focus of my book was purposely on more vocational calling, on work that is largely more compensated. There's more work to be done, more things that, to be said that I didn't say in the book about homemaking, about home, about caretaking, about volunteer activities. So there's all sorts of things that might be less relevant in a commercial society, but the itch I was scratching with the book was more vocational and compensatory work.
Sure.
But work is production of goods and services that meet the needs of humanity. It starts with a subject, it's extended towards an object, and it always and forever requires and involves service.
That's great.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, very, very timely book, sir. I'm really thankful for you writing it. I'm an employer, you know, and you know, somebody made the comment in my community that it was very self-serving of David Bahnsen to write a book about work, because he just wants everyone to generate more profit in the marketplace so he can make more money.
Guilty.
And my response. Yeah. My response was, well, you know, it's self-serving to any participant in the marketplace, because we all would benefit, you know, from having more, both as consumers and producers, we're all going to benefit from more productive, effective, competent people.
Larson, my guess is that the guy that made that comment, when he has a plumbing problem, he wants the plumber that comes to fix his house to be pretty productive.
But I would point out too, for not only do I honestly, I'm not being sarcastic, I gleefully accept that charge that I'm interested in there being more wealth created. But what is the implication of that? that what is that person's objective? That they would like to see more, less wealth created, or they would like to see that? In other words, I have an agenda. I want people to work harder. That's true. But does a critic have an agenda? They want people to work less? And if so, right, which one is talked about more in the Bible? Which one is talked about favorably versus unfavorably in the Bible? Are there warnings in the Bible against working too hard? Or are there warnings in the Bible against not working hard enough?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and to go back to something else that's been said here, David, I know you've benefited from Catholic social thought, and I have as well. But we Presbyterians have our own, you could say, body of social thought in the Westminster Larger and Shorter Catechism, particularly the section on the Ten Commandments. The way the Westminster Divines unpack the meaning of the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, is that we are, the positive side of that is we are required to enlarge our own estate and that of our neighbor. So it's not just cease stealing, it's also grow wealth. And grow wealth not just for yourself, but for your neighbor.
No, there's rich Catholic social thought on this, but there's absolutely rich Protestant thought. And in history, if anything, it was far more faithfully lived out in the tradition of Protestantism. Absolutely. I totally know that. I just don't like to turn down opportunities to upset Reformed people about my friendship with Catholics.
Well, I like to point people to humanprogress.org, knowing that it's not at all a Christian website, but it's a glory. If you click on the data page, you know, it's the improvement in the world across every single measurable facet of human life, from health to economics to violence to science to food and energy. I mean, across the board, the creation mandate is happening. You know, human beings are overcoming death, and turning the planet into a garden, ever so steadily, through primarily economic effort and innovation. And it's a beautiful, glorious thing. And it's part of the Great Commission. I mean, Rich and I talk a lot about how the Great Commission is really just a recapitulation of the Dominion mandate. It's an expansion and recapitulation of it. It's not a new program. It's more of the same.
Amen.
Just enhanced.
Well, and the kind of things you'll find at humanprogress.org not only I think show you the power of the free market to solve human problems and generate wealth. I think it's also very postmillennial. It's a kind of secular postmillennialism, but all the objective data tells us that the long-term trends are that human life is improving. And obviously we see all kinds of declension in our own time, in our own culture. Sure. I think a lot of that is tied to all the things we've talked about, ultimately are turning away from the Lord. But globally speaking, it's very clear to see that God's kingdom is growing. Globally speaking, it's very clear to see that God's principles for human life, when they're implemented, even by non-Christian people, are incredibly effective in producing blessing, peace, prosperity, human freedom, human virtue, human flourishing. So all those are good things to keep in mind. David, thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for your time with us. Thank you so much for this latest book. It's really good work.
Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate the thoughtful questions. Enjoyed the time with you. Reach out anytime.
All right.
Thank you very much.
The book again is Full Time by David Bahnsen. You can get it. I got my copy on Amazon. It's on Kindle as well as hardback. So definitely check it out if you get a chance.
Worth a read.
Yeah, good read. All right. Well, thanks again, David. Good to see you.
The God a Minute podcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. If you like this podcast, you might enjoy one of our other podcasts, The Good Life Podcast, featuring Matt Carpenter interviewing experts in their field about how their work contributes to the good life.